Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz Podcast. My guest today is Derek Schulman, known as the lead singer of Gentle Giant and the man who signed Bon Jovi, Cinderella, Slipknot, so many other acts. Derek, good to have you here.
Nice to be here with you, Bob. It's been a long time.
Absolutely. So there was recently a fan video of Proclamation, a Gentle Giant song. How did that come together?
It came together actually from my son, who has been bugging me since he was born, actually, about, and he's in his mid-30s, not having seen his father actually be a person on stage and having seen me on the other side of the business. And knowing that I was a musician before I joined the dark side of the business, as it were. And in the last few years, he's been seeing videos of me back in the day, 40 plus years ago. And he said, "Why?" And it's bizarre that the fan base that we had has grown exponentially. It was a kind of a smallish cultish fan base, but it's grown exponentially on the internet. And he said, "You should really do a reunion of some kind." I said, "Noah," his name is Noah, "that's not going to happen. I'm an old fart. I don't need to do that kind of stuff." But he said, "So you've got a lot of fans. Let's try this out." And I said, "Go for it if you want to." And in fact, he put the word out to the fan base out there. And he had hundreds of people sending their versions of Proclamation. And he convinced me, finally, to sing a line or two. And the other guys in the band who were alive, which generally they are, except for our drummer who passed away, our first drummer, quite a few years ago, to include our own little piece in the video. So we did that. He put it together. My brother Ray mixed the audio. And Noah put this video up. And in effect, Prog Magazine got involved and said, "This is great. We love this." And now it's got a lot of views, and it's kind of interesting that my band, which I left and we broke up 40 years ago, is probably more well-known, if you like, and more sort of have a bigger fan base than when we were going at the time. So it's kind of bizarre, but it was his idea, and he put it together. My brother Ray, who does a lot of audio stuff for a lot of other bands, 5.1 mixes, he did the audio mixes, which was damn difficult, by the way. So I just said, "Yeah, it sounds like a good idea." So I'm not going to take any credit for it.
Okay, why do you think your audience is so large and larger than it was 40 years ago?
Lots of answers to that question. I think that that it's going to sound trite, and it's going to sound, I hope, not pretentious, but I think the music held up. It was music which was authentic. It was music that we did for ourselves, rather than following a lead or following another band and saying, "Let's play like this." We were a band that put our own selves together and put our backgrounds and our loves of what kind of music influences together and became Gentle Giant. I mean, obviously, I started being in a band in the mid-60s when I was at school. So we went through a lot of things, but I think that the music held up and has held up because it's I hate to use a word that because it sounds like a pretentious word, but it's not. It really does have authenticity, and it doesn't sound like anyone else. We did never try to sound like anyone else. Of course, we all had influences personally of what we loved, and we all dragged in those influences into the band, and the band, those influences were stirred into a pot, if you like, and became Gentle Giant.
Okay. Today, and I know everybody hates being labeled, Gentle Giant was certainly seen as prog rock. Prog rock has a bad name in general. In addition, rock is not dominating the charts. Is this a passé style, or is there room for prog rock in today's world?
Bob, you know what? We never considered ourselves prog or rock, yes, but prog, no. We just did what we did, and luckily and thankfully, we put our band together at a time when there was no titling, there was no Chiron saying this is the kind of band you are. We were just a band that put our music our influences and our who we were together, and we made music that we enjoyed, and we pushed ourselves musically, personally for each other. And then we pushed ourselves musically for each other. We took it on stage, and hopefully one or two people would show up and pay money, and we'd make a living for it. So being labeled as a prog rock band, I don't think we ever considered what we were. We rocked because we enjoyed rocking. My background certainly is in R&B and blues and everything else. And my brothers were in classical, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as being relevant today, for me, it doesn't really matter. I don't care. But obviously, the way I've seen it and the way that what's transpired on the internet, it seems to be a little more relevant today than it used to be, actually, in a strange way. And because it's interesting to see the who sent in the music for this video, which you mentioned. And I would say three quarters, if not seven eighths of the people that sent in their musical pieces were people who are under 35. So we're not talking about old farts going back and saying, you know, trying to pick up the guitars and their arthritis getting in the way of them playing their instruments. It was young people listening to the music we made and enjoying it and enjoying it for a reason. And I guess the reason was because it was relevant to them. So I don't know if this answering a question or giving you an answer, but passe, I don't think so. I think that if it's the same as great jazz, it's the same as great dance music, it's the same as great musical, great classical music. It stands the test of time. And I think from what I see, I hope that our music has stood the test of time, which for me is kind of bizarre because I, 1980, 81, I joined the dark side of the business as you just introduced me to. The interesting thing that I've discovered and known and really is very, very interesting to me because, as you know, we've talked over the years about what this business is and who we are and how we are, how we get along in this crazy world of ours. And right now it's the craziest time. Having done most things in the business, if you like, what people come back to, and this is me personally, what people come back to for me is the music. It's not about the business. It's not about record sales. It's not about who's big and who's not. It's not about, you know, all the other means of hearing the streaming and this, that, and the other, TikToks and et cetera. It's about the music. And when people talk to me, it's not about Bon Jovi or Slipknot or Pantera or whatever. It's about what I did when I was a musician. And that's very heartening for me, actually.
Okay, so how did you decide to give up being a musician and go to the dark side?
Well, that's another story again, because as I explained to you prior, Gentle Giant, we started Gentle Giant in 1970, but I started my first group when I was at school in 1966. And that was an incredible period, I have to say. My first group was a group called Simon Dupree and the Big Sound. I was at school, my brother was at school, my elder brother was a school teacher. We put a band together and we loved R&B and blues and everything else, like most of the other classic rock bands of today did. And we went on the road. And even though I was at school, we went on the road and worked 9 days a week, literally, getting a fan base and eventually having a couple of very big hits. Those hits were good for us in certain respects, but became a millstone around our necks because we were expected to be a pop band and stay in the same groove. So I decided, we decided, I'm giving you a long story. And if it's too long, please
cut me off. No, I'll interrupt you if it's too long. Keep going.
So in 1970, when we broke the first band up, it was a decision that we were stymied by the fact that we were a pop band. And that really stopped us, doing something new. When we were playing to an audience who were eating scampi and chips, you know, and waiting for the hits, that really got to me more than anyone. So I said, we don't want to do this anymore. Thankfully, we had a manager, and this is back in the day when managers believed in musicians. We had a manager that undertook to finance a new project that we said we want to put together. And his name was Jerry Braun, and I give him full credit for this. He put money into our pockets for weekly, monthly salaries because he believed in us as musicians. So we found three other musicians. This is myself and my two other brothers, who we wanted to do something again new. We didn't know what it was, but it wasn't going to be what we were. We wanted to be the antithesis of this pop thing, which we got out of. And other bands were doing it at the very same time. I mentioned, bands like The Move, The Idle Race, Moody Blues. There's so many. At that period of time, the mid-60s to the late 60s to the 70s, all in England, it was an incredible time. I can't describe how amazing it was. And then from the early mid 70s, everything changed. But it was in the UK where it was so relevant and so obvious. Anyway, so we became Gentle Giant. We took about six months in rehearsals, and we found this keyboard player called Kerry Minear, who was a recent graduate of the Royal Academy of Music in composition, actually, and Gary Green, who was a real blues player. I mean, he was, he came in and wailed away. And in fact, he was the very first. We interviewed. I don't know how many guitarists, maybe 35, 40. And he was the very first one that said, "Can I tune up?" So he got this, he got a gold star next to his name. And we went through a couple of drummers, but the bottom line is, so we spent about 6 to 9 months recording, rehearsing and writing and putting this band together and putting our first, and then going into the studio in, I think, November of 1970 with Tony Visconti. As this group called Gentle Giant. It was really an amalgam of different kinds of music, different kind of influences that we came from and our newfound friends / band members that became what Gentle Giant became. And it was a really kind of the birth of a realization, if you like. That's the first song of a song called Giant. And that was where we were. That was the first recording of the 10-year career of being a Gentle Giant.
Yes, but we're leading up to the question, how did you decide to pack it in as a musician?
Oh, yes, you did say that. Well, as a musician in 1980. So 1970 was all, wow, this is amazing. And then we went through, bands and I think everyone goes through a seven generations of band, if you like. You're born, you're an adolescent, you become a young adult, you become an adult, you become middle-aged, you become older, and you become old. We became a little old towards the late 70s, and I just felt it both creatively and even the passion of going out in front of a crowd. And I remembered on the last tour, the idea of going out and playing the songs and recording. It was a whole sort of cycle of things. You record, you rehearse, you tour, you record, you rehearse, you tour. And as I said, that's what I brought up my prior A Gentle Giant life, if you like, because I'd done it for 15 years. And I remembered that we were touring USA again and playing Peoria, or Wayne, Indiana, or Fort Wayne, Indiana, should I say, and these kind of places held no sort of excitement for me. And when something feels like a job, And it felt like we were going out on a job. It really kind of feels like it's time to stop. And I would say this to anyone, no matter what your job is. And I know most people cannot do this, but the fact that a creative person would go out and say, oh God, we have to tour again. And okay, we have to get together in Buffalo and play the Buffalo gig. You know, it was like, do we have to? Yes, I guess we have to do it because we have to make a living. But when you feel that way in a creative world, that's the time to stop, because you're not being creative. You're not using any passion. It's like clocking in and clocking out. And that's, I kind of knew it. And I think some of the other members knew that it was like, okay, it feels like we're doing the same thing over and over again, unless we did something completely different, which I don't think we were able to do. Other bands of our ilk, like Yes and Genesis were, they were able to take their music into a pop direction. We never could. So it felt like a job. And when it feels like a job, we said, that's it. Time to stop. And we did.
Okay, well, was everybody on the same page? How long did it take to come to this conclusion? As you say, you've been doing it 15 years and you're only 30 years old.
Two or three of the band came to the same conclusion. A couple of the other guys were not of the same opinion. But nevertheless, what I didn't want to do, what I never want to do, and what I think my brothers never want to do, and perhaps the other guys of the band want to do and wanted to do, is become a parody of who you were and who you are, and to rehash the same things that you're doing over and over again. So, you know, it was a chapter, it was a fantastic chapter, and they all are, all pieces of life, but it was not something I wanted to go out and do the same thing. When it feels like a job, when it feels like you're clocking in and clocking out in the creative world, for me, it didn't work, and I had to stop. Otherwise,
okay,
it would have been miserable.
When you did stop, did you already have it in your mind what you were going to do next, or you just said, I can't do this anymore?
Bob, I had no clue. I had absolutely no clue. I knew I didn't want to do that anymore. I knew I didn't want to do the circus of touring and this and that and the other. That I knew. I had the opportunity to record, to be a producer. That didn't tickle my fancy either. I mean, I enjoyed being in the studio and working with the guys, but that really had no interest for me either, to be locked into a room 24/7, which had no darkness. So for a year or so, I had no clue. I was lost, to tell you the truth. And then a friend of mine...
Well, just to stay there, since you were on the road to earn a living, did you have enough money to not work for a year?
Believe it or not, thankfully, I did. It's strange to say this, but we were lucky, I guess lucky, in the respect that I took on the mantle halfway through the 70s of becoming the quasi manager and the guy that understood what it took on the other side of the fence, as well as being part of the band. In retrospect, it's a mistake. It was a mistake because you lose on one side because you're in the band, so you can't give a real objective viewpoint on that being a manager. At the same time, you're in the band, so you can't give your 100% attributes to being creative. However, what it did was again set me up for what I did next in a way that I think did me okay. So I was able to make sure that the band had enough money again, because I was looking after the monies coming in for the group, that we all shared it equally and knew where it was, as opposed to going in other people's pockets. So yes, I was able to get along and not work per se, if you like, for a year or so and wonder what the hell I was going to do. However, after a year and a half or whatever, it was going to get hairy. So thankfully, so to answer your question, that's exactly what it was. But I got a call from a friend in New York who I knew from UK. He was the head of Polygram International, who worked for Chrysalis Records, who we were signed to back in the day. And he said, have you ever thought about joining, a record company? And that was like an anathema to me. You know, what are you talking about? That's the enemy. But in certain respects, as you put it, clinically, I had to make a living. So I thought, well, you know what? Let me see. Let me give it a shot. So I went up to New York. I was living in California at the time, which I hated, by the way. Went up to New York and got offered a job as a promotion man, of all things, and an artist development, but promotion primarily.
But that's a grind, being a radio promotion person.
Well, the reason that I was hired, to tell you the truth, was because the guy who hired me, Jerry Jaffe, and all credit to him, the reason why he hired me, and this is, again, getting back to the prior lifetime, if you like, was because two of my biggest fans, or the biggest fans of the group, were Lee Abrams and Jeff Pollock. And Lee Abrams, of course, as you probably know, was a consultant to one of the biggest radio station consultants, and he was a big fan. And Jeff had another consultancy for radio. And I guess Jerry thought, boy, if Derek can get to him, then we're all set. Well, of course, that didn't work. But nevertheless, I think that's why I got the gig. But thankfully, I segued very quickly into something which I enjoyed more, was the music. But that's the reason, to tell you the truth, the reason why I got the gig in the first place.
Okay, so then it transmogrifies into the music. What does that look like?
Well, it was interesting because having been on the road and been a musician, I knew a lot of the musicians and bands and everything else. So a lot of people, managers and managers especially, would come in, they'd go to the A&R department. And that time, Polygram was kind of a bit of a mess. They were still trying to put Philips and Siemens together to make a real company. And in certain respects, it was kind of like a free-for-all. And there was no real sort of top-down leadership. It was more from the inside. And there was a group of us saying, let's make this company, let's do something interesting here. And there was already a few bands in the roster, like Kiss, like Def Leppard, etc. There were just bubbling under. And again, Jerry Braun, who was my manager for Gentle Giant, came in with my very first A&R thing, if you like, was he came in with a new Uriah Heep record. He didn't go to the A&R department. He came to me and said, Derek, do you think you can, you can convince anyone that's worth putting out? I said, let me hear it. And they had a couple of songs on the album. One song was called That's the Way That It Is. And the other song was called On the Rebound. And I said, I think this could do well. And in fact, I helped them get a deal. And in fact, that song became a decent sized hit and put them on the road again to being a band that was kind of meaningful in the US and sold quite a lot of records. So that made me think about segging into the A&R world, which I did very quickly since then. So I started promotion, but effectively went into A&R virtually straight away. I mean, with 6 months to a year, I was in A&R, but I still retained my radio people, friends and everything else. So, I was able to do all these things at the same time, knowing the bands and musicians and everything else. So one thing I just remembered was that the bands and the artists and the managers who came in would remember me from the road, because I was on the road until a year or two ago prior to that. And they knew that they couldn't say, well, you don't know what it's like to do this, or here we are doing this, because I did know what it's like. I knew what it was like to sleep in a van. I knew what it was like to live to fly in Concorde. I knew what it was like to sleep on a floor before a gig. So the one thing I had going for me, and I think those managers and musicians appreciated the fact that I didn't come from a world where I was just hanging out backstage wishing I was on stage. So I think I could relate to the managers and artists in a way that most other people couldn't.
Okay, so how did that lead to, after Uriah Heep, what came next?
Believe it or not, Bon Jovi.
So tell us the story of Bon Jovi.
Well, that was the first signing as a quote A&R man that I had, and in fact, the attorney of Bon Jovi at the time was a guy based in Philadelphia. I'd heard a song on WAPP called "Runaway." You know, that was running at the same time as I was listening to that, and I heard the song "Runaway," and I said, "Boy, that sounds great." And somebody introduced me to whoever it was, John Bon Jovi, who was Tony Bon Jovi's second cousin, who was at the power station. He recorded it. A guy called Arthur Mann. He was an attorney, and he said, "I've heard you like this song, Runaway. Can I bring you some demos?" And I said, "Sure, by all means." So he brought four demos to me, and he said, "John is great. He's putting a band together." I listened to the demos, and I said, "They sound pretty good, but I really like Runaway. I'd like to meet John." And so I did, and he was like not too many other people I've met in my life. This is prior to him putting his band together. He's still putting the band together. I think that Dave Sabo had just left, and I think Richie was just coming in. But John I met, and I've never seen anyone as young been so focused and driven. I mean, we're talking about someone who was a novice. So he's still working at the power station, sweeping floors, so he said, which he wasn't, by the way. There's a lot of bubbles to burst here, so
burst away.
He was a sinecure. He was playing around with the board when Tony wasn't looking, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, he got his job from his second cousin. John was one of the most driven people I've ever met in my life, even as a kid. He said, "I want you to meet my mom and dad." So I went to Sayreville, New Jersey, and met his mom and dad. And I did. And they said, "Look, if you're interested in working with John, please take care of him." They really did.
Why do you think he wanted you to meet his parents?
Because I think he believed in me. And I think he wanted to make sure his parents felt the same way. I believed in John as a personality, as a person that was completely driven to be he really believed he was going to be bigger than Elvis. And that was after one song, Runaway. And anyone who has that confidence, and you look at someone you look at someone in the eye and think, are they bullshitting me or not? He was not bullshitting me. I knew that. Instinctively, I know that. And he wanted to be the biggest. And I thought, if he wasn't that bad and he's that driven, I want to be part of this. So he put the band together and did a couple of showcases for me and the department. You know, one or two of them weren't that great, but you could see that John had an appeal, obviously, for girls. I mean, he's a good-looking kid with hair to the max. And Richie Sambora, who came in, was a great double act for him. You always have the yin and yang on stage. So Richie became the sort of yang of John's yin. We signed him to a deal.
How hard was it to convince the label, if at all?
Not that hard. Well, not that hard. I mean, I don't think that it was a rah-rah, let's go for it, it's going to be massive. But I felt it was. And I stuck with them, and I knew it possibly could be.
Okay, were you bidding against anybody else, or was Paul Graham the only?
No. I think there was interest in Atlantic, some kind of interest, but really not really anyone. And one thing I'd never done in my life, actually, to tell you, well, is go bid against it. I never would bid against anyone else. If that goes on, I'm out. I don't do that. That's not what I do. I never did that.
Well, tell us why.
Because then you're in a situation where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And the bottom line is if you're bidding, people are going to look at you with a microscope and say, "See, I told you so." That would never have worked for me. And thankfully, most of the bands you discussed, and I can talk about other ones, and some of them are big, big stiffs, but I won't talk about those. But they've been generally bands that have been overlooked or underplayed or whatever it is, that no one really else is interested in. I saw their potential. And, you know, having come from my musical background, if you like, I'd been lucky enough to, you know, on the scale of the success and the failure, there's been plenty of failures, but successes have weighed a little more, and I've been able to make a living.
Okay, so you signed Bon Jovi. What's the next step in terms of making music?
Putting the album together and then having going into the studio with Tony and Lance Quinn, who was the engineer, and putting the first album together with Runaway as the first single. And it did fairly well. I mean, but the most important thing, I think, at the same time, was getting Doc McGee involved. And that's another story in itself. Doc, and I know that there's lots of history and lots of history written and rewritten and everything else. Doc came into my office at the very same time that I was looking at Bon Jovi as a potential signing. And he was managing Pat Travers at the time and trying to get the band, the label interested in Pat Travers. But I saw Doc, and again, I saw someone who went to each office and worked every office like they were the main company, like they were running the company. I said, boy, this guy is a smart dude. He goes into every office and makes everyone feel like they're king shit. And so he came into my office and he said, yeah, Pat Travers. And I said, Doc, you know, Pat's great, but I mean, who else are you working with? I think it was some R&B artist. And I said, I've got this artist called Bon Jovi, and he's about to make a record. I want you to meet him. And at the same time, there was a couple of other managers who were sniffing around, David Krebs and John Scheer. But I wanted Doc to meet him because I saw how he was working every office and making them feel like they were running the company. And that was important for me if I was party to this whole thing. It's a very bizarre thing, and I'm telling you the truth, the sort of truth of what happened back in the day of how you had to work inside as well as outside. I had John meet with Doc, and it was love at first sight or first meeting. And they came to a deal. He had to meet the parents as well. And Doc was the first manager of Bon Jovi. And the first thing he did was say, do the album, but get your ass on the road, because right now you look like a little girl with you know, your purple tight leather pants on. So he put them on the road with Rat and Scorpions and God knows what else. And to tell you the truth, he was fantastic. And he put them on the road with bands that he wanted, and we wanted John and Bon Jovi to be the band that rocked with some great pop music, and to learn how to work that audience. So he was very instrumental in making Bon Jovi what they became.
Okay, so you make the first record, you have Runaway, you re-release in a better fashion. Now talk the second record.
The second record was a sophomore kind of flop, if you like, in certain respects, because they had to write new songs. You know, John and the band had written some of the songs probably over like the last 10 years. So they had to write some new songs, and we had to decide who we would record and produce it. Lance Quinn, who had worked at the power station, he was there on the first record. He said, let's record it in Philadelphia. So we did. And to tell you the truth, it was a bit of a disaster. It was really very, the atmosphere was awful. The songs were not quite as good as the first album. And it was an okay album, but it was not a great album. But nevertheless, it did okay. It was 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which I never agreed with the title. It was an awful title. The cover.
What was it supposed to mean?
The boiling point of, I don't know, was John the boiling point of stone or something? I really don't know, actually, to tell you the truth. It was not my idea. Again, it was, and neither Doc, it was like John's vision. But the recording was a terrible process. And in fact, I had to kind of fire Lance, and that was a process in itself. And get it finished by Tony, actually. Tony Bon Jovi to mix it, who didn't want to do it, but he did because he got points. But it was not a very pleasant experience. But it did the trick, in fact, in that he kept him out there, and John and Doc kept him out there working. It wasn't a stiff. It was an okay second album. It was a sophomore kind of slumpy record, but he kept him out there. And then we reassembled. If you were talking about Bon Jovi's career.
Yes.
Okay, we reassembled ourselves again after the touring. And I got to know Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock from listening to a couple of albums. And Bob, I was a fan of my old group. Again, this goes back to the fans and groups and the musicianship and everything else. And they just done Loverboy and Honeymoon Suite. And I listened to those records and I thought, boy, they have a great sound. And also the choruses and everything else were fantastic and everything else. At the same time, John and Doc and the band knew that to go to the next level, they needed to have, number one, a great producer. Number two, songs that would cut through the mist, the cut through the world of rock radio and AOR radio, whatever that meant. At the same time, MTV was the big marker in the house. So I another story. So I said, "Boy, John, would you think? What do you think about getting someone to write songs with you?" And John, being the pragmatist that he is, and being the driven person that would do most things to make sure he got there, he said, "Fine. Who are you thinking about?" And I said, well, I got introduced to this guy, Desmond Child, by Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, and I'd learned like the year before that they wrote Lick It Up. And I said, that's not a Kiss song. And Paul and Gene said, you remember Desmond Child Rouge? I said, yes, we were on Capitol together. Anyway, these stories intertwine.
Yeah, so keep going. This is great.
So I said, this guy, Desmond Child, apparently is really good because Kiss, Paul and Gene have told me that he's a great songwriter. Why don't you guys get together? And he said, fine, no problem. Let introduce me. So we did. And they got together and they wrote songs together. And I think, I'll just say the rest is history. Because I wrote Living on a Prayer, You Give Love a Bad Name, Bad Medicine, et cetera, et cetera. And Bon Jovi, and they went into the studio in Vancouver with Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock and Mike Fraser being on tape op. And they built their following, despite the fact that they were still on the road with all these other bands supporting it. But one thing that John was never afraid of, and the band was never afraid of, was playing. They toured and toured, and that was the key. They didn't let up. They knew that they had to continue to build their fan base, not just in North America, all over the world. So putting all these elements together, as soon as the album was done.
Okay, the album, was it an easy process? And two, did you realize what you had?
First question, easy process. Yes, it was. It was the easiest process we had. And we knew absolutely 100% when the album was mastered, absolutely 100% knew that this, we had it. We had something. This was going to be a big, big, big hit. I knew it. We all knew it.
And then there's a famous story that they had to can the original cover. Since you worked at the label, what was the story there?
Well, that's true. That's a fact, actually. There's a lot of, we had all the other people involved in the company wanted to be part of this success. So I don't know who decided that, this girl with a pink bikini that ripped off was a great idea for the title cut for the album cover. And we thought, boy, this is not a rock band. This is like, I mean, you want Billy Squire to go down the tubes. This is even better. So actually John, and John was the one that said, holy shit, we can't do this. At the same time, there's about 50 to 60,000 units already pressed up in the plant. So we held everything. And to be honest, John and Doc said, stop the presses. We have to get a new cover. And John and I think Mark Weiss went into their little studio. And John said, let's get a a plastic garbage bag, and I'm going to spray Slippery When Wet on this garbage bag, put my finger across it, take a picture of that. That's the cover. And all power to him, because it was his idea. And we had to change things in right in midstream, and that became the cover. And thank God that it did, because the other one is a disaster, or would have been looked at as a disaster, despite the fact that music inside the LP, as it was then, was great. But it would have been viewed like something we didn't want the band to be. So yes, that happened just as it was about to be released. Thankfully, we put the brakes on right at the last second, as far as the visuals were concerned. And I think the first song out was Bad Name, I believe it was. And then Living on a Prayer was the second track. And then...
Okay, so a little bit slower. What happened? You put out the record. Does it react immediately? What's it like being at the belly of the beast?
Through the roof. I mean, it was. There are times in your life. You know, there are peaks and valleys, and I just remember number one hearing this album and knowing I knew that this was it. I knew it, and when you heard it on the radio. And you saw it on MTV. We got Wayne, the videographer. Anyway, the guy who does all the best videos to do the video, which looked like it was on. You know, he was playing in front of 20,000 people when he was only playing in front of 2,000, if that, when he was doing it. The video looked amazing. The song went on the radio. It immediately became a gigantic hit. Immediately. And the album just blew into number one. It was like something that you rarely see in your lifetime. And it was a spectacular time for everyone, for the company, for the band, for Doc and everyone else. And to tell you the truth, for me, because I believed in him as someone who wanted this so badly and knew he had the potential of talent to do what he wanted to do. And to see it through with other people helping him. So, you know, it wasn't just John, although John is an incredible quick learner, and boy, does he ever, you know, he's like a sponge who takes it in and it becomes him. But he had all these other people behind him to make this probably one of the biggest albums, of rock albums of all time.
Okay. Now, at Geffen at this time, the A&R people had a piece of the record. Did you have a piece of Bon Jovi's records?
Yes, I did.
Okay, that's great. You still get paid on them?
No, I don't. Because I don't. I wish I did. Boy, that was I'm not sure. I could be locked down somewhere else, I guess, in a cruise ship. No, I don't. But at that time, yes, I did. I was.
Well, why did the royalties end?
Because I quit the company.
Okay, so it was only long you were there. Okay, at the same time you're working with Cinderella, how do you get Cinderella?
Cinderella was another band from the Philadelphia area, New Jersey, Philadelphia area. I think it was introduced to me by, again, the same manager, same agent. But again, John knew Tom Kiefer. Again, these things intertwine, and I can't put timelines. It's very difficult to put timelines in between who said what, when, and whatever. But I remembered, and Larry Mazur, who was the manager, contacted me and said, boy, you did a great job with Bon Jovi. I've got this band, Cinderella, and I'd heard about them because Arthur Mann, the Philadelphia lawyer, said this has got another great band in out of the area. I went down to see Cinderella. In a little club, I can't remember what the club was, and they weren't that good, to tell you the truth. Tom was fantastic. Tom was an incredible frontman, and Jeff, I think, was a good guitarist, was great. But the other two guys, they didn't hold up. I said, Larry, you know, you've got someone in the front there that's great, but you have to replace the other two guys. And I'd heard, and at the same time, he gave me Tom's, I don't know how many demos. He did. There must have been at least 75 demos. I mean, we're talking about a prolific writer. And I listened to the demos, and I would say 30 of those were worthy to put on an album, first album. So I said to Larry, put a great band together and I'll give you a deal. And he found two other players that fitted the mold that I think were worthwhile for Tom to front. And I did the deal. There was no one else involved. I mean, it was almost like me doing something sight unseen. But I listened to the music that Tom was writing and signed the band to Polygram and got Andy Johns, of all people, to produce that album, which was a treat in itself, to say the least. But that's another story. But anyway, that first album, I think it was Night Songs. At the same time, then Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet was high on the charts. That came out literally a little time after Slippery When Wet and blasted into the charts as well. So I was, you know, I had two of the top five albums that I discovered, and I was hot shit.
Okay, a couple of questions. Anyone ever debate the name Cinderella? Did Kiefer come with Cinderella?
I think it was. Yep. I think it was Kiefer and Larry, you know, I didn't dispute it. I thought it was fine. I think you could play around with it. You could play around with the visuals. I mean, we did on the first couple of videos. They were funny. They were kind of like, in fact, I got John involved in one of the videos. Again, this is the old MTV time when breaking a record was getting it on MTV and getting it on the radio, and then you're off to the races. Boy, that was the time when the jigsaw puzzle was five pieces, not 5,000.
Well put. Okay, there was never really another Cinderella album. What happened there?
No, they had Night Songs, and they had the follow-up, which is that did well too, and I can't remember the damn name. I wish I could. No, that was they had two really big albums, and then I left. I left Polygram to run Atco. And they still continued their career. John, of course, he went into Din, New Jersey.
Okay, but a couple of questions. They said that Tom lost his voice. Is that true? That was probably after you were there at Polygram.
Yeah, that was after. Yes, he did. Yeah, I'm still friends with Tom. Tom's a great guy. I mean, he really is a wonderful guy and a real talent. And the truth is that we locked onto the MTV Hair thing, and Tom really was a blueser, and he loved blues and the whole sort of the blues thing. But yes, he did. He lost his voice. He had nodules on his vocal cords for quite a period of time. He was living in Nashville, and he told me that. And he said he was afraid that he wouldn't be able to sing, but he got them back, and he's still in a great voice, which I'm happy about.
Were you still at Polygram when Bon Jovi made New Jersey?
I was literally walking out the door when he was making New Jersey.
Okay. From my viewpoint, I love Slippery When Wet, but Bon Jovi, in my viewpoint, has never equaled that. And I even bought New Jersey when it came out and was disappointed. Do you have any insight in? Once again, do you believe you were the special sauce? What was going on?
Boy, but that's if I thought that, then if I think that or thought that in any form, in any way, that, you know, then somebody shoot me in the head, for God's sake. I was certainly intrinsic. I really was, but everyone, it wasn't just me. It was the company. It was Doc. It was the agent. It was John himself. It was a band. It was everything. But certainly we had a chemistry together to make Slippery as big and as good as it was. When I left, I mean, you know, when I left, maybe there was a little lack of, you know, in intimacy with a label. I don't know. I mean, I can't say for sure. Maybe John was getting a little bored. I mean, he was working his ass off. I mean, they toured, but I was there when they started it, but I wasn't really there when they finished. I was, my next step was
before we get to your next step, when they would be making these records, since you were a musician and you have experience, to what degree did you weigh in on the material and the studio, not only say yes or thumbs up or thumbs down, say, well, you know, should we change this? Should we try this?
I actually did quite a lot on some albums, not so much the Bon Jovi ones, because I was there in the studio for sure in Vancouver with Bruce Fairburn was a great musician, and Bob Rock himself is a great musician. You know, I'd listen to certain things and they say, what do you think? I wasn't one to pipe up and say, I think you should do this, because you know, we had enough talent in the room to know what was best and say yes or no to. However, with Cinderella, I was a little more proactive, but in both their live show and as well as writing. And when they, to give you an insight about live, when Cinderella first went out, because their record came out and they weren't really a live band yet. And suddenly they were all over MTV. They were all over the radio and they had never done real gigs. They played a few club shows in Philadelphia. And they went out there, and I can't remember who they went out with, but they weren't very good. And I went back to Larry and went back to the band and said, you have to videotape every damn show and take them back to the bus and watch these shows and ask yourself, will you pay $20 to see this band? Watch it. You've got to watch this. And I have to say, they took it to heart. And they watched themselves and said, boy, I made a mistake there. That choreography was awful. I should be doing this instead of that. So, you know, they listened. So I said, do that. At the same time, you know, I'd sit down with Tom. And in fact, okay, a little bit of insight, which there's a song called whatever it was, but I co-wrote it. And I, to tell you the truth, I said, Tom, you got to do this because this sounds better. And I co-wrote a couple of songs with Tom, because I knew that sometimes he'd ramble on a chorus or a verse, a verse at a B section, and didn't get to the chorus quick enough. So I'd work with him on a musical level. I said, you know, try this chord, try to step it up a fourth, et cetera, et cetera. And he was very open to that and loved me being part of that. So
did you take credit for that?
No.
Okay. So tell us how you end up going to ATCO.
Well, ATCO was another story. So, you know, during the period of that PolyGram, I had Bon Jovi. I had, I also, at the same time, had another band, Kingdom Come, which went blasted into the charts, into the top five, because I gave Bob Rock his first production. And you know, everyone screams and yells, oh, it's a Led Zeppelin, copy band, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know what? It was perfect first time, and the band, it was all over the radio, and at the same time I was working with Dexys and Tears of Fears, etc., and worked with a couple of other bands which were ultimately successful in different fashions. And so I guess I was hot shit, as they were, you know, at that time. So, and I thought, you know what, I'm looking at the people who run these companies, I'd like to try it. I really want to do something like this. They at PolyGram, they said, well, we'll give you Mercury, we'll give you this. And I'd already done 82 to 87, 88, 6-7 years. I said, I want to try something new. And I got wooed by Geffen, by Irving, by all the players involved.
Okay, did you put it out there or did they find you?
No, I decided that I was going I wanted to run a label. You know, I wanted to see what it was like and to put a team together, because I put the team together. I put teams together as a band. I put teams together in working records and having the right managers and the right agents. And I wanted to see if I could put a team together to run a company. So my lawyer, I said, I'm going to resign to PolyGram. They did not want me to resign. They offered me to be a label head of something else. And I, you know, even though it would have made me a lot of money, I would have kept the points for Bon Jovi, the points for Cinderella, et cetera, et cetera. But that, for me, and this is going to sound bizarre, I think, to a lot of people, it wasn't about the money. It was about the challenge and it was about the passion. So, you know, I gave up a couple of points. Okay. Let me do something new. It's the same thing as I talked to you about when I was on the road. It's time when it feels like I'm going to do the same thing with the same people again, like a job, and find the next Bon Jovi or the next Cinderella or the next. No, let me try something new. So, you know, I wanted to try something new and to run a label was something new. So I got offered, you know, to run a couple of companies. But I met with Steve Ross at Warner Music a couple of times. I met with Ahmet and Doug first, and then Steve Ross. And he was the one. He was one guy that I was most impressed by, and the reason, and the stories are I can give you hundreds of stories about why and what and everything else. And I met with Yetnikoff, and you know they took me around to having dinners with hookers and God knows what else. That wasn't what I want. That wasn't who I was. It was like, come on, I want to run something which is something for me. They didn't know who I was, but Steve Ross sat with me. And he just come back from the Bahamas, I think. And we talked, and he asked me what I did, what I wanted to do, in a very kind of like easygoing fashion. And again, these are little vignettes I have in my head. He had a basket of little raffia, you know, knickknacks, you know, like you buy for a dollar in a Bahamas, you know. And I said, well, those are cool. Where'd you get them? He said, I just came back from the Bahamas for a meeting. He said, you want one? Just a little dollar thing. And the fact that he gave me this little dollar knickknack, and it got to me. I thought, well, he didn't offer me, you know, the plane, you know, the private jet to this. Yeah. He said, do you want this little dollar knickknack? And obviously you had Warner Music at that time. You had Warners, you had Elektra, you had Atlantic, you know, Doug and Ahmet but that incident and his vision of having entrepreneurs in the company, someone who could do something without being told what to do and could make his company a profit, if you like, and also do well personally, financially, was his MO. But I loved the way that he presented what it was, of course. Warner Music was a spectacular company at that time. But that incident in particular was one which I walked away, I thought, no, he didn't have to do that. He could have said, I'll fly you to so-and-so, I'll do this and that and the other. But he gave me this little knick-knack. And I walked away, I thought, well, you know, that kind of did it for me. And so I said, I'd like to resurrect this company that has been dormant, Atco Records. And Ahmet said, sure, fine. I mean, let's go for it. Doug was a little iffy about that, but that's neither here nor there.
Doug was iffy. Wait. That comes up like
Doug was iffy because he saw this guy come into this company that had all these successes at Polygram, and at the time Atlantic was kind of like they were kind of in a low period, and I think that potentially possibly he thought I was coming in as a replacement. That was so far from my thought process. It was beyond belief, but I believe that he was a little threatened by my coming in to being head of ATCO alongside Atlantic Records. So he was a little iffy about me taking on ATCO company and putting a team together, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's another story which I can embellish, if you like. But we got along ultimately, you know, in the way that I guess one should.
Okay, so you're now at ATCO. You have the Rembrandts, you have a hit, you have Pantera. So what's it like there running your own company?
The first two or three years, fantastic. Amazing. You know, I was given free rein. The first year, obviously, you had to build a team, and I kind of stole the best people from Polygram because they were kind of like going through their some machinations of being bought or whatever. I got a really good team together. I was lucky enough to have a couple of pretty decent sized hits straight away. Pantera being one. And in fact, the funny story about Pantera was I was going to sign them to Polygram. But I knew that I was leaving, and so I said to the attorney at the time, who's no longer with us, can you wait until I'm, I whispered in his ear. And I signed them to ADCO, and Pantera was a huge hit out of the box. And Doug, this is a story about Doug actually. He didn't know who Pantera was. He thought it was some kind of hip hop. He really did. He thought it was some kind of like, is this a new Dr. Dre production? And of course it wasn't. But it was great for the first 2 or 3 years. Then in the fifth year, whatever it was, I started losing perspective of what I was in it for. I came into meetings and I had my general manager. The company became bigger. We were just a rock label. I took on the mantle of Ruthless Records, of all things. We had a couple of very big hits on Ruthless, which is a hip hop, as you know, Ruthless Records. It was Jerry Heller and some pop records. And I remember one thing in particular. Again, these little points of career development and why you did things, why you didn't do things. I was sitting in my general manager's office, and I heard this song on the radio. It was called "Sincerely Yours" by I'm black. Sorry, I'm it's a long day today. But "Sincerely," I said to Harry Palmer, "Harry, what? I like the song. What is this? I've heard it before." And he looked at me like I was joking. And I said, "He said it's ours. It's in top number one." That was a turning point for me. I went home and I thought, boy, I've lost perspective of who I am. I was wearing a suit, you know, and I thought, I just lost. I'm losing Derek. I'm losing Derek Shulman as someone who loves music, loves being involved in the music business. And the last couple of years were not that good. I didn't like it. And I decided to quit. They didn't want me to quit.
Wait. Are we rewriting history? Didn't Doug sort of push you?
He wanted to push me big time. Big. When I was in Russia, absolutely. He offered me co-chairman because he wanted Sylvia Roan in there as well. But I was up at the same time. No, I'm not rewriting history. There was a lot of intrigue going on because Time Warner was involved. But Doug was certainly very much afraid that I was, you know, getting in his way. He's taken a lot of power away from Bob Morgado and that team there. But it kind of drifted away. Yes, he certainly wanted me away out of there. But nevertheless, I had a contract and I had a company. However, at the same, so it was, you know, so he. We met when I came back from Russia, and when I was out of the country, he tried to have a coup, but it didn't quite work. So I came back, and he said, "Well, you could be co-chairman. You got X number of points and everything else." I said, "Doug, I'm out of here." They kept me there for another year and a half, actually. So I said, "No, I don't want to do this." It was the same thing as I did when I said, "You asked me about leaving Gentle Giant." No. It was not the money. I didn't want to do it. I'm over it. See you later. So no, Doug was certainly trying to get rid of this guy who may be, you know, on the prowl to get his job. But nevertheless, when he offered me to be the co-chairman with Sylvia and get lots of points and lots of money and XXX, I said, "No, I'm out of here." My attorney went apeshit at me. So what are you talking about? So I'm done. I'm resigning. They wouldn't let me go for a year and a half because I had a contract. So I had to literally stay there and work with Irving on some things. But it was really kind of like a sinecure. You know, I was not allowed to go anywhere. It's like an NDA, if you like. But I had to be a part of the Warner Group Music Group. So you asked me how it was the first three or three and a half years, 4 years were great. Last two were awful.
And you were working with Irving on what? With Giant then?
Yeah, Giant. Yeah, we did something together on Giant. I put some records together, but it was really not. I was really working through a contract that I was with Warner Music effectively.
Okay, so your contract runs out. Then what?
Then I took a time out, 6 months. And, you know, again, you decide, you know, what is it you want to do? I mean, running a big corporation and looking at myself in the mirror with a suit and listening to something on the radio that I didn't even know belonged to us really got to me. And I tore the suit off myself and put shorts and t-shirt back on and said, the hell, I got to get back to being Derek again. About 6 months into not sure again what to do, thankfully I had enough to live on and we were not financially strapped. I was living in New York, my wife and I had two kids in school and everything else. I got a call from an old friend, Case Vessels at Roadrunner Records. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm not much. I'm deciding what to do. He said, would you mind we meet? And because I've got this label in Soho. We've got a couple of good metal acts, but I'd love to see the company become a big label. And I said, okay, let me see what you've got. So I met with Case. I knew Case from Europe over the years. I knew him when he worked for RCA, and I met with him, and I saw the people in the office. And at that time, he was trying to build a label, a kind of an all-purpose label. He had a dance label, he had a hip hop label, he had this and that and the other. But when I looked inside at the company, there was all these kids with like tattoos and piercings and God knows what. This was a rock label. That's a Case. You're doing something. You're spending money on all these other things, and you've got kids in there who love Type O Negative or Fear Factory, and you're trying to break this hip hop stuff and Salt and Pepper or some other thing from another dance label. Or you have to get rid of things and focus on what you do best. So and I don't think he understood that he had a brand. So I kind of. For a year, I kind of consulted under the radar and became the consultant to get rid of some of the stuff, the chaff from the wheat. And then I became president of Roadrunner Records. And I really enjoyed that because it was to focus on what that was and what it could be was a lot of fun because it was an independent label. It wasn't run by a board of directors. We went, Time Warner, and that whole situation there became a nightmare. When it was Warner Music Group, it was great. When it became Time Warner, which again is another story entirely, that's when the dog thing and Margada and Fuchs and everything else became a mess. But this is a whole thing, a new independent company that was run by this guy, Case Vessel, as he wanted it to be a big, powerful label, but to keep to keep whatever he had. I don't think he even knew what he had because his love was more Wagner than Coal Chamber or Slipknot. He hated that stuff. But I saw what he had in the company and the people who he'd hired. And I said, this is what you're going to do. Focus on what you do best. So I became president of Roadrunner. And it was a great time.
How did you sign Slipknot, or was Slipknot already signed?
No, Slipknot wasn't signed. What I did was again, number one, move away from the stuff that he thought could make a popular company popular and focus on what was best. And the people there were great. They were fantastic. They were really passionate people, passionate kids that would work 24/7 to get the rock stuff going. I think the biggest breakthrough, yes, was number one, getting Coal Chamber and Fear Factory to a different level. They were bands that had already been signed by Monty Connor, and he was a great A&R guy. There's some very good people in there. But I brought in a guy called Dave Longo from RCA as a head of promotion, because promotion still meant something in those days, radio promotion. And then I think that Monty and myself brought in Slipknot together with me. But I knew when I saw Slipknot play, he said, what do you think? I looked at them and I felt the same way as I did with Pantera. I knew they had it. They were never going to be on MTV. They were never going to be on the radio. But boy, they could play to fans all over the damn world. They were a purely fan-based. I said, this is the band we're going to spend a lot of money on. This is a green light band. And of course, it's the first album went to the races. It became huge. And that made the company, in certain respects, made the company take a big step into the big mainstream rock label, sort of independent rock label. And then the biggest next step, if you like, and then probably the worst step and the best step again, was spreading the core from the hardcore metal world into a more melodic, bigger label. And in that respect, why I brought in Dave Longo as a head of promotion was to get some of the bands that we had signed on the radio. For instance, Fear Factory did a song called Cars, and that got on the radio. Typo Negative got a song on the radio. But I signed a band called Nickelback. Ron Berman had brought in several tapes, and Nickelback was one of them. And I kept listening to this song on the first album. And I kept playing it. I said, this guy's a great writer. Who the hell is it? And Ron said, it's a guy called Chad Kroger, and he's got a brother, and it's a band called Nickelback. I said, tell me about them. So he told me about them. We went to see them in Vancouver. And they were fantastic writers. And we signed them. And the first album had the black, again, I'm sorry, I'm blacking on tracks and everything else. The first album did very well with that, with the first track we put out. You know, Dave was able to get tons of airplay. And then they put together the second album, which is, again, another milestone in, I guess, my career, if you like, Silver Side Up, with How You Remind Me. When you hear that song, How You Remind Me, I knew as soon as I heard that, that was going to be an absolute home run smash, no matter who did it, how it was done. And of course, Dave got it to the top of the charts, and Nickelback became massive. It made a lot of money for the label. And it became something of a millstone round Case's neck, and perhaps mine, because unfortunately Case, having just been part of a little company that did very well in a little world, suddenly opened up to become a gigantic label that took a lot of income, and he wanted more of it. And those kind of albums and those kind of songs come along once every 10 years. They don't come along every damn 6 minutes. So trying to look for the next one and spending money to do that was the wrong direction for the company. And ultimately, it wasn't right for me. It wasn't right for Case. And the company became, there was a lot of things that happened to the company, and that put me off being part of it, because he made a mistake in Europe by putting the company in a financial scrap in North America. And that stopped me being able to do what I could do in North America. I said, Case, this is not going to work. So again, I said, I can't do this anymore. And he had to sell the company at a fairly good profit, but certainly not what he should have been worth when it was done. So that was the Roadrunner world and the Roadrunner days, which were great for the most part, really were. They were fantastic. And since then, I've been kind of consulting various labels and dilling about and doodling and becoming an old fart.
Okay, why does everybody hate Nickelback?
I think, to tell you the truth, I don't think they do. I think it's a guilty pleasure for most people. But I think that it's the incarnation of corporate rock, as we all know. And you know what? Yes, it is. But you know what? So is a lot. I mean, I think corporate rock is, corporate rock is part of what we're doing. Look, corporate rock is everywhere. I mean, I think TikTok and YouTube and everything else is corporate rock as well. So I think it became the sort of target for all things that were bad, that were the man, if you like, which of course it was to a certain degree, but nevertheless, it certainly was not something that people disliked when they bought it, and there's not a band that people didn't not like when they were going. And they're still, you know, they're still around, and they still write good songs. And it's funny because when I was there, they weren't the sort of target of being the most uncool band in the world. You know, it's the same as Bon Jovi's the most uncool guy in the world. You know, so like he cares. You know, uncool doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean shit. You know, sorry, I don't believe in cool or uncool. I believe in first thing is do what you do. Do what you do best. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Okay, wait. I didn't hear that. You don't believe in what?
Being uncool or cool.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, while people, this turn of the century, that's when How You Remind Me came out. 2001, 2 was really big. While all this was going on, all the corporate stuff happened in the 90s with Warner, et cetera. But then we had the disruption of Napster. Everybody's bitching about stealing music, and everyone's bitching about Nickelback. But they don't realize that hip-hop is dominating the internet.
Correct.
And hip-hop gave it away for free with mixtapes, and hip-hop was on SoundCloud, such that at the turn of the decade, when streaming really becomes big with Spotify, suddenly it's all hip-hop.
Correct.
Okay. As someone who has made his bones and really understands rock, A, is there a future for rock? Is there a place for rock today? And B, does it have to be adjusted to regain market share, to use a corporate term?
Well, is there a market for rock? Yes, of course there is. I mean, all these big festivals all over the world, which are non-existent right now, of course, in this day and age, they're all headlined by rock bands. However, you know, these are rock bands that made their mark in the 70s. So, I mean, they're going to be dying soon. Yes, it's a gigantic marketplace. I don't think the hip-hop world and the pop world and the YouTube world and the TikTok world can fill that gap. But certainly as far as the live music business is concerned, it's 100% rock driven. Of course it is. But nevertheless, on a different level, you'd be surprised. And I'm surprised. And I'm surprised that the world of hip hop is actually a lot more musical and musically diverse than most other worlds, most other businesses are concerned. And I'll give you a case in point. I had a gold record presented to me by a band called Run the Jewels, who has a song, which is a song called Legend Has It, which is the lead song on Black Panther. They sampled one of Gentle Giant's songs. And that world has gone back to listening to some of the music which was authentic. I guess the 70s prog music, believe it or not, Common, and the guys in Roots, they're all fans of music, rock music of the 70s and progressive music, actually. That's a very interesting fact. That is a very interesting sidebar that I don't think not many people know about. They're the most musically interested and interesting people that are around, actually, in some respects. So to answer the question about rock being viable, of course it is. Right now it isn't, because it's all about live. And as far as streaming is concerned, you know, I see that people are pissed off that they don't get enough streaming, and Spotify's Daniel Ek is becoming this vilified kind of guy. That's bullshit. I'm sorry. You know, it's silly. You know what? You know, because you know, back in the day, I was thinking when I was reading about all this stuff and people complaining that he's a greedy fuck and all that stuff. You know, I'll go back to my beginnings in the music business. When I first got a deal, and this is, I got to take myself all the way back now to 1966, 67, as Simon Dufresne and the Big Sound, we had a great following. We were playing our asses off. We played triples and quadruples, if you've heard of them. You played an afternoon show. You played an evening show. You played an all-nighter. And then you literally do these shows all over the country, all over UK, and Europe too, and you became pretty damn good at what you did. You know, if you didn't, then you didn't become a band. And then we got a record deal, and our record deal. And our record deal was based on a demo, which was sent up to EMI. So EMI invited us up to Abbey Road, and we had to do a full set on stage at Abbey Road with the producers, including George Martin, Norrie Paramore, et cetera, all the producers looking at us, sitting there like this. We had to do our full show.
Arms crossed for those in the non-video world.
arms crossed. And we did the full set of Simon Dufresne and the Big Sound set. And lo and behold, we got a record deal. But the record deal was one single. And that was a record deal. You know, and the one single came out. We were fortunate enough to have it hit the lower parts of the top 40. So we did another record. But the record deals in those days, they weren't album deals. They were one singles. I don't think the Beatles had a record deal. I think there was a one single deal. Love Me Do. That was it. So, I mean, back in the day, it was about the singles, and we did singles. So, and that's how we built our fan base, our reputation. The album thing was a whole different animal. That was the 70s. But the 60s were all about record deals. And even bands like Deep Purple, who was, you know, they were me and Gillan and Roger Glover, were in a band called Episode 6. They did singles. You know, you can, the Idol Racer, Robert Plant was in the band of Joy. They did singles. You know, so all these bands, that was the day when you did singles and you were lucky to get a deal. And that's how you got a deal. You did a whole set in front of these producers and you were lucky to get a deal. So now I'm looking at these people saying, oh, 3 or 4 years for an album, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, you know, I understand. I did albums too, but you know what? It is what, again, I'll quote our favorite guy who was sitting in the White House. It is what it is. And then that's ironic, by the way. I'm sorry. That's a bit of this irony for it. It is about the song. It is about what it is. And it's today's world and not last year's or last month's or 10 or 15, 20 years ago. And I do have sometimes a problem in talking to someone of those periods that, and they have all these gold and platinum albums on their walls and saying, that's not going to happen anymore. It's over. You will not have those anymore. And they're shrugging their shoulders thinking, why? Because that was then and this is now. You know, it's a bizarre twist, but the weirdest twist for me is having these hip hop musicians hearkening back to music which they thought was relevant and authentic. And I just got a gold record, as I said, from Run the Jewels with Killer Mike and LP. They're huge fans of mine, and that's bizarre. Not of what I've done with Bon Jovi or Pantera, but my as a musician, and that's the key to it.
Well, that brings us full circle, literally, starting with Gentle Giant, ending up with Gentle Giant. Listen, this has been so informative. You tell a great story. Thanks so much for doing this, Derek.
My pleasure, Bob. It's great to see you again as well.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.